From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor Bill Paxton. He tells us about Frailty, the film with which he made his directing debut. It's now out on video. And about how his father, who was not a professional actor, ended up in the movies. Also, we hear a 1993 interview with the late pop artist Roy Lichtenstein. A new book reproduces some of his prints. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Lost in the Stars by the Ken Paplowski Quartet. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Red Dragon, starring Anthony Hopkins. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix emerged from a meeting with Secretary of State Colin Powell to say he, too, thinks new weapons inspections should wait until a new Security Council resolution on Iraq is in place. Powell has been trying to delay the return of inspectors until they're guaranteed unfettered access to Iraqi sites.
We think the best way to support their efforts is with a new UN Security Council resolution setting out very tough standards and conditions for the conduct of new inspections.
Blix agreed today, saying it would be awkward for inspectors to go in and then find there was no resolution. John Walker Lynn has been sentenced to 20 years in jail for serving the Taliban. The sentence was part of a plea agreement the government and Lynn accepted earlier. In a prison jumpsuit, the tearful 21-year-old renounced terrorism and Osama bin Laden, saying he had known the Taliban was harboring terrorists. He never would have joined its army. Lynn agreed to cooperate with authorities. In a federal courtroom in Boston today, Richard Reed showed no remorse as he admitted to trying to ignite a shoe bomb and attempting to kill the 197 people aboard a Paris to Miami flight last December. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Richard Reed smirked in court today as a federal judge asked him about the attempted bombing, which Reed described as an act of war, not an act of violence. Reed also declared his allegiance to Osama bin Laden before pleading guilty to attempted murder and seven other charges. Prosecutors are stressing they did not cut a deal.
The fact that Reed has chosen to plead guilty in no way mitigates his actions, which were those of an Al-Qaeda-trained terrorist, plain and simple.
U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan says federal sentencing guidelines demand that Reed get a sentence between 60 years to life.
Reed should never be released from federal custody. He should remain in prison for the rest of his natural life.
A sentencing hearing is set for January 8th. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
The first full debate on a resolution to authorize a military strike against Iraq got underway on the Senate floor today, NPR's David Wellner reports.
There were hard and serious questions raised during the opening hours of the Iraq debate. Massachusetts Democrat Ted Kennedy asked how it could be that just 4 months ago, the CIA chief said Al-Qaeda, not Iraq, was the main threat to the U.S.
And I don't know what's changed, and neither do the American people. That's what they want to hear. They hope they'll hear that during this debate.
Virginia's John Warner, who's the top Republican on the Armed Services Committee, said some disturbing facts about Iraq are not widely known.
I'm urging the administration to try and share more information with the Congress this week and to perhaps declassify it.
A White House-backed Iraq resolution is expected to sail through the House, but
NPR's David Wellner reporting from the Capitol. You're listening to NPR News. A jury in California has awarded a record-setting verdict in a tobacco liability case. Jurors ordered Philip Morris to pay $28 billion to a lung cancer patient who says smoking made her sick. NPR's Adam Huckberg reports.
Jurors deliberated about a day and a half before announcing a verdict that far exceeds any other in a tobacco lawsuit. Philip Morris, the world's largest cigarette maker, was ordered to pay $28 billion to a 64-year-old smoker named Betty Bullock. She said the company concealed the dangers of tobacco when she began smoking at age 17. The company said Bullock chose to smoke and keep smoking even after the risks became well known. The $28 billion punitive damage award is on top of $850,000 in compensatory damages the jury awarded to Bullock last week. Her case represents the fourth consecutive individual liability case tobacco companies have lost in California. A previous $3 billion verdict won by another smoker eventually was reduced to $100 million. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
The King of Nepal has fired that country's prime minister and disbanded his cabinet. It is the first time since the end of the absolute monarchy in 1990 that a Nepalese king has ousted the government's elected representatives. The announcement on Radio Nepal comes a day after the prime minister asked the monarch to postpone November's parliamentary elections by 1 year. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrial Average fell 188 points, or nearly 2.5%, to close at 75.28 in heavy trading on volume of 1.8 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite lost 25 points, or 2.2%. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today from our archives, actor Bill Paxton. His films include A Simple Plan, One False Move, and the big-budget pictures Twister and Apollo 13. Earlier this year, Paxton made his debut as a director with the thriller Frailty, in which he also starred. The film is now out on video and DVD. Paxton plays a man who recently lost his wife and is raising his two sons. One night he has a vision, which he shares with his two boys.
The end of the world is coming. It's near. The angel showed me. There are demons among us. The devil has released them for the final battle. It's being fought right now. But nobody knows it except us and us.
I'm scared, Dad.
Nothing to be afraid of, Tiger. We've been chosen by God. He will protect us. He's given us special jobs to do. We don't fear these demons. We destroy them. We pick them up one by one and we pitch them out of this world. That's God's purpose for us. The angel called us God's hands.
So we're like superheroes?
That's right. We're a family of superheroes that are going to help save the world.
But, Dad, that doesn't make any sense.
I know it sounds that way, son, but it's the truth.
After sharing this vision with his sons, Paxton, guided by the vision, kidnaps and brings home several people whom the angel says really are demons. For the greater good of the world, he kills them with an axe. He asks his son to help him with the murders. The younger son has faith in his father and his visions. The older son is sure his father has lost his mind, but loves him and is afraid to turn him in. Terry spoke with Bill Paxton last April when Frailty was in theaters.
Since Frailty is about a father who has these visions,
yes,
and he really believes that an angel has come to him and told him to kill people who aren't really people, they're demons,
yeah.
And he takes the message to heart and starts killing people.
Yes.
Were you afraid when you made this movie that a lot of Christians would be very angry and take it as an affront against fundamentalists in particular or Christians in general?
No, I didn't make this movie to offend anyone's personal or religious beliefs. This movie is not the gospel according to us, the filmmakers. This is a what-if movie, and it deals with some fundamental belief issues that deal with the Old Testament. But it also deals with the idea. See, for me, Frailty is a family tragedy, and even though you don't know till the end of the movie what is kind of true and what is false, and who is good and who is evil, I always saw it as a familial tragedy. And whether this God, this Old Testament deity, came to this man and or not, it's still the final result was chaos and destruction of a beautiful family. I guess I was always disturbed by certain stories in the Old Testament. I was raised in the Catholic Church, and I guess it was more about Jesus and you know, loving one another. I think to me, the movie ultimately is really about the folly of man's ego when he ordains himself to be God's executioner or punisher. I didn't make the movie to be controversial. I really kind of made it because I thought it was a good gothic kind of grim fairy tale.
This is just a very practical question.
Mm-hmm.
Your film, Frailty, starts with the credit sequence. Mm-hmm. A lot of films are nowadays, the credits don't come till the end of the movie, or maybe they come 5 minutes into the movie. Just on a practical level like that, how do you decide where you want to put the credits?
Actually, the images we did were from a collection of Master Detective magazines that I collected. They're mostly from the 30s and 40s and 50s.
These are still photographs. These are still photographs that you see in the opening sequence.
And what it gave us a chance to set the tone.
They're kind of crime scene photographs.
Crime scene, kind of rural crime scene photographs. There's something about, you know, you see in a guy, you know, pointing into the lake, or you see an arrow in the woods, and it's pointing to a mound, and just something like, what was that? What happened there? You know, this movie has to do with the whole kind of idea of kind of murder out yonder, stuff that takes place beyond the city limits, where, you know, people are isolated and, you know, things can go undetected for a long time, and the desolation of people kind of being separated.
Since you play a father in Frailty, tell us about your father.
I'm very close to my dad. I was raised in Fort Worth, Texas, and I come from a family of four kids. And I have an older brother and a younger brother and a younger sister. And when I was a kid growing up in Fort Worth, my dad loved movies and plays, and obviously it affected my life's career. But my dad loved to go to movies, and he would take me and my older brother Bob to downtown to Fort Worth, that was where there were like three kind of main old movie palaces. I remember the Palace, the Worth, and the Hollywood. My dad would never take us to a Disney film. If we wanted to see something like that, then we had to go to a Saturday matinee. My dad liked to see, these were probably not R-rated movies, but, you know, movies like the Bond films and different things. I remember seeing the Ipcress File and Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte and some of those. And when we'd come out of the films, he would talk about the artifice of the films. He'd say, I really like the lighting or the props or the camera work or the Sean Connery's tailor. And in a way, at first we thought, what the hell is he talking about? And then after a while, we started kind of digging the artifice and we would discuss it. And I guess from an early age, I was aware of the illusion of filmmaking. And I've always loved the illusion. I've always loved, you know, the idea of image makers and you know, creating these other worlds that are fabricated.
What did your father do for a living?
My dad worked for his father in a family-run hardwood lumber business. They were hardwood wholesalers out of the Midwest. It started in Kansas City back before the First World War. And after World War II, my dad and his brothers went to work for their dad. My dad, there was a yard in Chicago, and eventually, after he married my mom, he moved down to Fort Worth, Texas, because there was a yard there as well. And he traveled, mostly calling on the trade, cabinet makers, musical instrument makers. He loved people, and he loved art. Over the years, he's kind of been my greatest resource. He sent me books like Simple Plan and Lords of Discipline when they were still in hardback, and said, hey, they just sold this to the movies. You got to go in there and try to see if you can do this. And he's been a great inspiration to me.
I understand that one of your father's dreams was to act himself, and he actually yes. has a small part in the movie A Simple Plan that you starred in.
Yes, he does.
And I thought I could play this scene.
Oh, terrific.
Let me introduce the scene. Jump in if I don't have any of the details
yes.
straight. Okay, in A Simple Plan, you, your brother, and a friend, and your brother's played by Billy Bob Thornton, the three of you stumble on this small plane that's crashed outside of town. And
yes,
there's
in the snow.
Millions of dollars
that's right.
in this plane, and you decide to keep the money.
Yeah.
So while, you know, all kinds of terrible things happen, but anyways, while you're struggling with this guilt, because you know you're doing something that goes against your nature, but you're going to keep the money anyways, you're working in this feed store, and a customer walks in, you're very distracted, a customer walks in and complains that he thinks maybe he's been
overcharged.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And the customer is played by your father.
It is.
Here's the scene.
You listening to me, Hank? Every Monday I come down here, buy two bags of feed, regular as clockwork. Two bags a week, four times a month. That's eight bags I'm supposed to be billed for. I don't know how else to get through
this. December started on a Monday, Mr. Schmidt, so there were five Mondays in the month. So you came in here.
Are you telling me there were 5 weeks last month?
No, sir, I'm telling you there were five Mondays. Excuse me.
Oh, I got it. Yeah.
Hey, Hank, it's me.
Hang on a second. Listen, check that calendar over there if you don't believe me, sir.
It's Bill Paxton and his father, John Paxton, in a scene from A Simple Plan. What's the story behind the scene?
Well, there's a few stories. I mean, my dad sent me this book when it was a hardback, and I think it had only been out about 4 weeks. This is a debut novel by a great writer named Scott Smith. And he sent it to me, and he said, you won't be able to lay it down. It's got a lot of hair on it. I don't know what that means, but that means it's good, especially coming from my dad. I sat down to read this book. I could not lay it down. I called my dad after I read it, and I said, Dad, I'll never get to play this part. It's a brilliant part, but I'll never get to do it. I think there'll be a lot more prominent actors who will be lining up to do this. And over 5 years, I watched other actors who were slated to do it, but for one reason or another, the film kept capitulating, and eventually I kind of won the role by default, one of the greatest roles I ever got to play. I go up to start production. Sam Raimi directed the picture, and we started production actually in northern Wisconsin, but the production office I landed in was in Minneapolis. I walk into the production office to see Sam, and I'm looking up at the wall, and they usually put our the actors' 8x10s on the production office wall, and you know, there's Billy Bob, there's Bridget Fonda, Brent Briscoe, there's my dad, there's Chelsea. Wait a second, what's my dad doing up there? Now, my dad, I got to back this up a little bit. My dad retired from the lumber business about 10 years ago and basically said, I really always wanted to be an actor. And I said, oh my gosh, you mean my life's work is just some continuation of your fantasy? Anyway, he had written Sam Raimi a letter and said, I've always admired your films, and I was wondering if there were any small parts that I'd possibly be right for.
And he didn't tell you he was doing that?
And he didn't tell me that. And Sam, a real gentleman, said, well, I liked your dad's letter, so I thought I'd give him a chance. And I said to Sam, well, he better be good.
Was it bizarre to work opposite him in a scene?
It was very bizarre, very bizarre. And I realized he was, you know, he's an older guy, and he was kind of falling into a rhythm with his lines. And so I had to kind of shake him up a little bit. And I said, you know, come in and give me the business like you give it to me as Bill, you know. Like, my dad will want me to send an autograph picture to some guy at an auto body shop, and, boy, he will fax me, he will call me, he will just rail me till I take care of it. And so I said, give me some of that. And I kind of got him worked up, and I kind of gave Sam the signal to be ready to go. And once I thought I had him a good froth worked up with my dad. They rolled the cameras, and he really nailed it.
Bill Paxton speaking last spring with Terry Gross. Frailty, the actor's first film as a director, is out now on video and DVD. We'll hear more of the interview after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Bill Paxton, the star of big-budget films like Twister and Apollo 13, and independent films like One False Move and A Simple Plan.
Now, I want to play another scene from A Simple Plan. And again, in this movie, your brother, played by Billy Bob Thornton, and a friend come upon this plane that's crashed, a small plane, and there's $4 million there. You decide to keep it, although your character knows that it's morally the wrong thing. But you do it anyways because it's too irresistible.
Mm.
And there's just one bad consequence after another that happens as a result of keeping this money. And you have to keep covering up things. You have to cover up that you're keeping the money, and then you commit a murder, and you have to cover up the murder. And one bad deed leads to another bad deed.
Once you start digging that hole, the more you dig, the deeper you get in.
Right. Now, in this scene, Your brother, who's kind of a little mentally slow and socially slow, your brother, played by Billy Bob Thornton, has asked you to meet him at the farm that your parents used to own. And
poignant scene.
Yeah, and in this scene, you know, you've already both murdered somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Your brother's asked you to meet you at the farm. It's now broken down in total disrepair. Your brother tells you that he'd actually like to buy back the farm and live there. Let's hear the scene.
Jacob.
Farming? Come on. You don't just buy a farm. You gotta work it. You gotta know about machinery and seed.
I know that.
No, you don't. Fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, drainage, irrigation, the weather. Come on, you don't know about any of that stuff. You're gonna end up just like Dad.
Why do you think he ended up like that?
I'll tell you how he ended up like that. He had two mortgages riding on the place. He couldn't make the payments.
Where do you think the money went?
He was a bad businessman.
Where do you think the money went? No, you think he spent it all on the farm? I'll tell you exactly where the money went. 4 years of college, bud. Yeah, didn't you ever think about how he paid for that? Didn't that ever occur to you?
No, my tuition was...
Listen, I'm supposed to get the farm. What do I get? I'm supposed to get the farm.
Jacob, you got the whole world. You can...
I don't want to hear that.
You can go anywhere you want.
This is what I want. This is where I want to be. It's my home, Hank.
That's Billy Bob Thornton and my guest Bill Paxton in a scene from A Simple Plan.
That's a very poignant scene. The idea that the brother, Jacob, wants to stay and fix up the old farm. I think for a lot of guys like the character that Billy plays, and women of the same, you know, background, something about their childhood that they want to go back to. Whereas most of us grow up and we move on and we have memories of our childhood, fond or indifferent. But, you know, we realize as we mature, you have to kind of let things go and move on. But many people get stuck in the past. And it's such a poignant thing when he wants to fix up the old farm. That movie is an intensely personal film for me because my relationship with my older brother, Bob, who is one of the great gentle lambs of the world, but I think in his heart of hearts he wishes we still all lived on Indian Creek Drive in Fort Worth, Texas, and he's had a tough adulthood and been through a lot of stuff, and I drew off of that relationship, so for me, being in the movie was, again, it was very, very personal.
In what other ways does he remind you of the brother in your movie?
Well, he has the same kind of sly sense of humor, my brother, and he has kind of a penchant for saying the appropriate thing at the awkward moment. And actually, I had Billy talk to my brother on the phone several times, and he drew his character from my brother, as well as kind of the innocence of his own relationship and the innocence of his own children. He was kind of playing that innocence in the role.
Did you feel a responsibility to guide your brother in the same way that your character feels a responsibility toward his brother in the movie?
Yeah, I've been very involved in my brother's life. He's kind of my closest sibling in many ways, just because physically we grew up together, we went to camps together, and after his accident when he was 24.
What accident?
He was in a car accident and lost most of his eyesight, and he had had emotional problems before then and just compounded everything. He came up and lived with me in New York City. I was struggling. I remember I was working as a doorman at the Paramount Theater up in Columbus Circle there, and we lived in a kind of a one-room flat with my girlfriend down in the East Village, and those were kind of tough times, but we look back and we laugh about them now. We've always been close, my brother and I.
Now, you were in the remake of Mighty Joe Young a few years ago.
Yes.
I grew up watching that film over and over.
I did, too.
I lived in New York where on Million Dollar Movie they'd show
the
same movie all week.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, they'd show the marquee, the Million Dollar
Marquee.
Yeah,
so Mighty Joe Young was on just all the time, and... You know, Joe, no one can hurt you now.
And what a surrealistic movie. You know, I guess that because of the success of King Kong, RKO wanted to try to capitalize on that franchise, but how do you capitalize on it when Kong dies in the first film? I mean, so they came up with this new concept of this other, you know, the smaller, you know, giant gorilla.
Smaller and more family-oriented.
yeah, exactly. Although when you watch that movie now, you realize just how politically incorrect it was, the way they're throwing those lions around in that nightclub scene and the way the guy's feeding Joe the liquor and getting him all agitated. And they wouldn't let you make a movie like that today. One of the highlights for me was the idea that I was getting to reprise the role that was played by the great cowboy actor Ben Johnson. Ben, I got to meet years ago in a little movie called Back to Back that starred Apollonia. And Ben Johnson was in it, and an actor named Luke Askew, who plays the sheriff in Frailty. He plays the villainous sheriff. And we were down in Arizona at the bottom of the Superstition Mountains, shooting in a little town called Apache Junction. It's where Elvis shot Charo years ago. That was...
Where else have I seen the sheriff? I didn't see Back to Back, so where else would I have
Luke
seen
Askew it? Was in my movie Traveler that I produced.
I saw that.
Luke,
okay, maybe that's
he played it. The head of the gypsy clan that I was a part of.
It.
But he was a very well-known actor. You would have remembered him from movies like Easy Rider, Cool Hand Luke, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, the Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid, The Green Berets, Hurry Sundown.
Oh, okay.
He was very outspoken, kind of a Southern intellectual, raised a lot of hell, got himself, I think, kind of blacklisted in a way, but one of the most intelligent actors I've ever worked with. And I've kind of been on a crusade to kind of see him make a comeback. And I love Luke. And Luke actually gave me the idea for making the angel more of kind of an archangel with a flaming sword.
Well, I thought he looked like Kirk Douglas.
He did. Yeah, I wanted to go for that kind of Spartacus
kind exactly.
of look.
Yeah, exactly. Spartacus era. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and these old vengeful angels from the Old Testament, when they showed up, it wasn't a good thing. You know, you read passages like we were afraid to gaze upon its countenance. And usually when, you know, these angels showed up, something nasty was about to go down. You know, they did kind of God's dirty work, so to speak.
Well, Bill Paxton, thanks so much for talking with us.
The pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Bill Paxton speaking earlier this year with Terry Gross. His film Frailty, in which he does double duty as director and star, has just been released on video and DVD. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Audi and the all-new A4 Cabriolet, available October 2002. Open up your world. Information at AudiUSA.com. And Delacourt Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takeshi Matsuoka. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Music from Lost in the Stars, the new CD by the Ken Paplowski Quartet. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews it. Also, we hear from the late pop artist Roy Lichtenstein. A new book from the National Gallery of Art collects some of his prints. And David Edelstein reviews Red Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Early in his career, clarinetist and saxophonist Ken Paplowski toured with the orchestra of Buddy Morrow, playing the music of swing band leader Tommy Dorsey. He also played Dixieland in New York and was a member of Benny Goodman's last band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Paplowski's new CD has some more modern touches, but he still keeps close ties to jazz's past and to his own.
Clarinetist Ken Paplowski on piece number 8 from a series of vignettes by Morton Gould called Benny's Gig. Benny, as in Benny Goodman. Paplowski doesn't sound like Goodman, but there are similarities in his tight control over the instrument and a sound as bright and clear as a chilly morning. Ken Paplowski has been recording for years, but his new album, Lost in the Stars, shows him off especially well. He's got a good band, sparked by the fine drummer Lewis Nash, good original tunes by members of the quartet, and some classic songs that haven't been done to death. The arrangements are simple enough to let the players develop the material without interference, and jazz can always use an eloquent clarinet player. On ballads, Paplowski spends a lot of time rummaging in the horn's lower range. He gets a full and resonant sound to make you hear clarinet as a long, hollow pipe. This is from Kurt Weill's My Ship. I like the sturdiness of Ken Paplowski's clarinet sound, but I wouldn't call it warm exactly. Sometimes he gets a more intimate sound on the bigger tenor saxophone. On pianist Ben Aronov's Lament, he evokes Stan Getz's romantic streak. Lament also shows how closely the band can track him while just staying out of his way. That's Greg Cohen on bass. Ken Paplowski can turn up the heat on tenor sax, too. A piece accompanied by just bass and drums recalls Sonny Rollins' epic trio recordings of the 1950s and 60s. Full speed ahead, with drummer Lewis Nash at the throttle. That tune is Sleep, big band leader Fred Waring's theme song from 1923. A few things about Ken Paplowski suggest he's happy to live in the musical past. his deepest roots still lie in the 1930s swing era, which may explain the slight sense of emotional distance I hear in his playing. It's a bit like he's painting new landscapes in the style of the old masters. It's a stunt in a way, but a respectable one. A new canvas in an old style can still look mighty good up on the wall.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Lost in the Stars by the Ken Paplowski Quartet. Coming up, we hear from the late pop artist Roy Lichtenstein. This is Fresh Air. If you're in New York and want to see the work by pop artist Roy Lichtenstein, you could take a subway to the museum, or you could just take the subway. A 53-foot mural that Lichtenstein created for the subway system in 1994, but that has been in storage ever since, was finally installed and unveiled last month. It's called the Times Square Mural, and that's where you'll find it, near the main subway entrance at the intersection of two of the city's most famous streets, Broadway and 42nd Street. The mural is one of two new projects showcasing Lichtenstein, who died in 1997 at the age of 73. The other is a new art book overview, which has just been published. It's called The Prince of Roy Lichtenstein. Lichtenstein brought the style and subject matter of pop culture into the fine arts. He put wham and blam into his paintings, literally. His early paintings from the 1960s were inspired by comic books. In fact, they look just like frames from romance comics, war comics, and Mickey Mouse, including the thought balloons and the Socko Pow exclamations. Terry spoke with Roy Lichtenstein in 1993 at the time of a major retrospective at the Guggenheim Museum. She asked him why he wanted to do his own versions of romance comics and war comics.
I guess what I liked about both of them is that they're both emotional in different ways. I mean, the war things are full of action, and the women are crying,
right. You
know, or waiting for telephone calls or something. And that is the stereotype portrayed in comic books at the time, which really reflected the feeling of society. And but the idea of doing highly emotional subject matter in a very dry, mechanical, removed way seemed to symbolize something about where society was. I mean, wars were being waged at a push of the button and things like that.
In one of your love comics, a worried woman is asking the man who is with her, it's not an engagement ring, is it? And in the catalog that accompanies your show at the Guggenheim, they reprint the comic that you base that on. It's from a Winnie Winkle comic.
Mm-hmm.
And the context that comes from, the woman is saying, Perry, about this piece of jewelry you're planning to buy for Tanya. And he says, I just want to show her how much she means to me. And then the woman says, It's not an engagement ring, is it?
I know. It's a completely different thing when it's taken out of context.
Yeah. So now, what interested you in that particular Winnie Winkle?
Well, it wasn't the Winnie Winkle. It was just a pretty girl and a handsome man,
mm-hmm.
and those stereotypes. And the cliché of being enthralled about engagement rings. I mean, I'm sure everyone is even now, but it seemed like a male and a female thing to do.
All of your paintings, or maybe I should say most of your paintings, mm-hmm. Come from print matter, from a two-dimensional source, from a, mm-hmm. from comics or from advertisements, or in some cases from other paintings. You seldom, if ever, paint from life itself.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? I mean, you know, there's the tradition in art that mm-hmm. you're painting from the still life or the model or the landscape. You're painting from life, not from a reproduction of life.
Yeah. Well, I know that. I even did that before. I mean, when I was in the 50s, I had several shows in New York, which not many people know about. And the work was kind of expressionist and cubist and, you know, very derivative in retrospect. And it was from historical paintings or paintings of cowboys and Indians or something like that. So I always seem to have used two-dimensional sources. And, you know, I mean, I feel that artists are always using two-dimensional sources. They just think they're using three-dimensional sources. In other words, if we all started to learn to draw and paint simply by looking at the model, we'd all be painting like children. You know, it really is that you're painting in terms of the history of art, and you're really making a drawing of a life model the way Michelangelo did. You know, I don't mean that there have been no advances in this, but mostly all of that seeing is learned from looking at two-dimensional sources, not three-dimensional sources.
You did a series of paintings of brushstrokes, and of course in abstract expressionism, you know, brushstrokes and dripping paint were about what it was all about. I mean, it was about seeing the action, the process of the painting, the hand of the painter, the drip of the paint.
Yeah.
But of course, the brushstrokes that you painted had no real dripping paint at all. I mean, the drips were carefully colored in. was this your comment on abstract expressionism, this kind of ironic version of brushstrokes?
No, I think it was a comment on the comparison between that bravura act that they did with paint and the my way of representing it, which is it's where I'm painstakingly drawing the brushstroke up, you know, as though I were painting something difficult to paint, you know, and that one is romantic and the other is classical, and that it's really a drawing of an ideal brushstroke or something that looks like a brushstroke. And it doesn't fool you. I mean, you don't think it's real, that it's really a brushstroke, but you think it's a picture of a brushstroke, and, you know, that's a kind of absurd thing to do. And so it has that built-in absurdity, and that's the reason I like it.
There's a chapter in the catalog that accompanies your Guggenheim show, a chapter that's called Clichés into Icons. Mm-hmm. Is that what you see yourself as doing, transforming clichés into icons?
Well, I like the idea, and I do think that there's a relationship between classical art and cliché. I mean, the Greeks or Romans, we look at as trying to make ideal figures or ideals of beauty and that sort of thing. And so are comic strip people. They're making an ideal pretty girl or handsome man or whatever the thing is, rocket ship. And but one is thought of as important and the other isn't. And but by making archetypes, I am trying to make them into icons. And if you, particularly even in sculpture where I isolate something, you know, it can be a lamp that's standing on its light rays, you know, or something like that, or a German expressionist head or something. I try to make it as cliched or as typical or whatever it is. And that's really the same thing, I think, as making it classical.
You know what I'm going to ask you about? The style that you paint in, that style that looks like mechanical reproduction but isn't, this is a style that you appropriated from mass culture. But it seems to me at this point it's become something else. It's become your style. It's become your personal style. So painting in that style must feel really different than it did when you started. It must have really become a way to express yourself, to a very personal vocabulary for you. One that you must be very comfortable with.
Yeah, I think
with.
That's, you're explaining it very well, that because it originally had that meaning, this is printing and so forth, and I don't think that's, even though it still may mean that, it certainly not doesn't reveal anything, and it's just become a way of making colors. So now or tonalities. I use dots and diagonals and dots that graduate from thick to thin, and I mix them up in the painting with other colors. And it just became a way of working. And if I could find a way out, I would be happy to do that, you know. But the way has to mean something. And I tried one group, which I like a lot, of landscapes made of brushstrokes, some of which are real brushstrokes and some are cartooned brushstrokes. And they work together in the painting, and it gives the painting a certain interesting surface, which I would have disdained a few years ago. But so I'm trying to do various things and trying to extend it, but I don't want to make it complicated or decorative. And I like the plainness of it, but it is just the way I work. And it's interesting that what would become every man's style, is very recognizable.
Roy Lichtenstein, speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. Lichtenstein passed away in 1997. A collection of his work from 1948 through 1997 has just been published. It's called The Prince of Roy Lichtenstein. Let's take a moment to note two people who have recently passed away. The first is television writer, producer, and director Bruce Paltrow, who died Wednesday at age 58. To many, Paltrow and his wife, actress Blythe Danner, may be best known as the parents of their Oscar-winning daughter, Gwyneth Paltrow. But Bruce Paltrow, the man behind the TV series The White Shadow and Saint Elsewhere, deserves to be remembered fondly by anyone who cherishes quality television. In those two series, especially Saint Elsewhere, Paltrow broke all the rules of dramatic series television. People died without notice. Outrageous comedy butted right up against gut-wrenching drama. Actors, writers, directors, everybody got a chance to learn, stretch, and grow, and TV grew a lot as a result. The people Paltrow trained all went on to maintain that quest for innovation and quality. Actors like Denzel Washington and David Morse, directors like Thomas Carter, producers like Tom Fontana and Mark Tinker. Paltrow was a great guy who did great work, and his legacy lives on in such series as NYPD Blue and The Sopranos. We also learned that jazz pianist Ellis Larkins died last Sunday at the age of 79. He was a respected accompanist who recorded with a number of vocalists, most prominently Ella Fitzgerald. Producer Chris Ellis wrote that Larkins, quote, shares with Teddy Wilson the distinction of being one of the few pianists who can complement the work of a singer. Knowing just the right phrase to play to give the singer a perfect springboard, filling in such a manner that the line of music thought is perfectly carried on, and even more importantly, never playing too much and getting in the singer's way. He recorded this with Ella Fitzgerald in 1950. Storm never failing.
day you're mine, this world will be in tune. Let's make that day come soon. Let's make that day come soon.
Ella Fitzgerald with pianist Ellis Larkins, recorded in 1950. Larkins passed away last Sunday at the age of 79. Coming up, the latest from Lecter, a review of the new film Red Dragon. This is Fresh Air. Red Dragon is the new movie adaptation of Thomas Harris's first thriller to feature Hannibal Lecter, the ferocious anti-hero of The Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal. The movie stars Anthony Hopkins, reprising his Oscar-winning performance for the second time, and is being advertised as the first installment in the Hannibal Lecter trilogy. David Edelstein has a review.
Thomas Harris's novel Red Dragon was filmed once before, in 1986, by Michael Mann, who had to change the name to Manhunter because the studio thought Red Dragon sounded vaguely Japanese. It featured CSI's William Peterson as the ex-FBI profiler Will Graham and Tom Noonan as the deformed serial killer Francis Dollarhide, who enters the houses of suburban families while they sleep. It also featured the Irish stage actor Brian Cox in the peripheral but thematically central role of Hannibal Lecter, the cannibalistic madman who'd nearly killed Graham some years before, and who was now being consulted as some sort of psycho killer emeritus. Manhunter wasn't a hit, but it was shown on TV a lot after Silence of the Lambs became a phenomenon. And after last year's Lamb sequel, Hannibal, made hundreds of millions of dollars, someone at the Dino De Laurentiis company decided that this particular udder could be given another squeeze, that people would line up to see the same story again with Anthony Hopkins doing his Lecter number. The new director, Brett Ratner, does one thing spectacularly. He demonstrates what a great and seminal movie Manhunter is. His Red Dragon tells the same story with many of the same lines. The best ones are straight from the novel. And that story is good enough to carry you along. It has a fun new Lecter prologue and a new climax with a twist that sends the audience home happy. But it's otherwise a thoroughly lame piece of movie making. It doesn't get under your skin. It won't haunt your dreams. It won't change the way you think about this serial killer obsession that has strangled our culture for decades. The movie is an arm's length experience. Before I say why, let's listen to the picture's unhaunting central scene, in which the imprisoned Lecter taunts his old adversary, Graham, played now by Edward Norton.
You stink of fear under that cheap lotion. You stink of fear, Will, but you're not a coward. You fear me, but still you came here. You fear this shy boy, yet still you seek him out. Don't you understand, Will? You caught me because we are very much alike. Without our imaginations, we'd be like all those other poor dullards. Fear is the price of our instrument, but I can help you bear it.
We're very much alike? Excuse me? This Bela Lugosi lookalike and this gangly twerp with his aw shucks demeanor? I don't think so. When Brian Cox's Lecter said that line in Manhunter, it was palpably true. He and William Peterson had the same morbid sadness, and so did Tom Noonan as the killer. That name, Dollar Hyde, suggests a Mr. Hyde born of sadness. He was like Peterson and Cox stretched out. But the three actors in Red Dragon inhabit different histrionic universes. That's not a small point in a story in which each character is obsessed with getting into the heads of the others. Edward Norton can be a good, nervy actor, but his reedy little tenor doesn't begin to suggest the unsavory depths of Graham. Ralph Fiennes would have been more interesting, but he's been cast as the killer. Partly because of how he's photographed and directed, his psychosis has no mythic component. When he travels to the Brooklyn Museum to eat the Blake painting that inspired his Red Dragon persona, that's right, I said, to eat it, he might as well be munching a burrito. Ratner apes some of Jonathan Demme's visual strategies from Silence of the Lambs, but Demme was coming from a bustling ensemble universe of such movies as Melvin and Howard and Something Wild. His close-ups of Lecter were so terrifying because they seemed to rip the fabric of his humanist universe. Anthony Hopkins by now is running on pure ham. He's such a seething little extrovert. It's like a vaudeville act. You're probably thinking I'd rather talk about Manhunter than Red Dragon, and my answer is yeah, that's true. In part, it's because Ratner, who has little talent that I can discern, has publicly disparaged Michael Mann. But more than that, it's to point out Manhunter's astonishing influence. It led to CSI and John Doe and Profiler and Millennium and all the other movies and TV shows that didn't just borrow from Thomas Harris's plot. They borrowed Mann's moody underpinnings. After this, thrillers would not only get fetishistic about autopsy rooms and elements of forensics, they would fixate on that single haunted protagonist, someone who would wander fresh murder sites and stare at glossies of victims and relive the slaughter from the killer's point of view, someone who would be able, at a terrible cost, to plunge deep into a psycho's roiling psyche. Red Dragon is just another gory freak show, but Manhunter, that ushered in a new era. The age of empathy for the devil.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. And Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Jackie Robinson and the integration of baseball by Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition. Now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The author of The Hot Zone about the Ebola virus has a new book about the threat of smallpox. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Richard Preston, author of The Demon in the Freezer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
There is a dark side to Muddy Waters. In the foreword to the book, Keith Richards writes, there's a demon in all of